This is The Happy Station, broadcasting to North and South America on 9,955 kHz from 1 to 155 UTC and from 15 to 1555 UTC.
Radio Berlin International.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
This is Radio Nederland, the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland.
You're tuned to Swiss Radio International in Bern.
This is Free China as a presentation of the Voice of Free China, the international service of the Broadcasting Corporation of China.
This is Radio Havana, Cuba.
Broadcasting from Cuba, free territory in the Americas.
This is Radio South Africa.
This is Yugoslavia Radio Belgrade calling.
This is Israel broadcasting from Jerusalem.
This is Radio Kenyan of the Democratic People's Republic of Kenya.
This is the General Overseas Service of the BBC.
Happy Station presents a tribute to DXers, produced and presented by Keith Perrone.
Well, of course, with that opening, which is different from our usual signature tune, as you know, it's now time for one of our special DX programs. Now, when I was preparing this one, there were a number of things that I could have done. We could have done a lot of, you know, like featuring one subject and then talk about that from different guests. But I decided to feature one guest, someone whose voice is well known to international listeners, because for 24 years he was one of the co-hosts of the Swiss Shortwave Merry-Go-Round on Swiss Radio International, and that is Bob Zanotti. Now, one thing about Bob that makes him extremely special, he's a man after my own heart, because Bob is the kind of person that doesn't pull punches. He says it like it is. Quite recently, we had a very lengthy conversation. It was almost 90 minutes. And I have to tell you, this was probably the most difficult interview to edit down, for the reason that it was extremely interesting, and there was a lot of information that I would have loved to have kept for the entire show, but we're working with time, so that can't be done. So on this edition of Happy Station's Tribute to DXers, my guest is Bob Zanotti. Now, something I think which is the best way to begin is, how did it all begin for Bob? Because Bob did spend some time in Montreal.
I was a student. I have to go back. In 1964, I was a student. I just graduated high school. I'm originally from the state of New Jersey, northeastern New Jersey, just outside New York, and I was a student in communication arts and broadcasting at the New York Institute of Technology. And I had an opportunity through a Swedish friend to work as a freelancer, do a sort of practicum, as they call it in academics, in Stockholm.
Now I wanted to ask you, at that time, were you also a shortwave listener? I mean, were you familiar with Radio Sweden?
Oh, yes, I listened to it. And that's the short story of how I got to Europe, first of all. And I won't forget your question about CKGM. But my grandfather was the one who introduced me to radio. He was an avid shortwave listener back in the 1930s and 40s. In fact, he told me stories, and I sat there wide-eyed and fascinated in Hawthorne, New Jersey, and he would show me his big, upright Crosley cabinet radio with the big, booming bass speakers, and he would tell me how he could hear Tokyo and how he could listen to Rome and London on this radio, and he had a wire strung outside in the backyard, and he really got me fascinated. And unfortunately, the technology was not up to the reputation of shortwave. That old Crosley from the 1930s couldn't receive anything but WABC AM 770, 50 kilowatts, about 3 miles away from us. And then when I was a boy, around 10, I guess, a brand new Helicrafters S38E receiver was waiting for me under the Christmas tree one morning. And I remember nobody saw me for about 4 days. I had my food sent upstairs, and I was up there in my room, and I had a wire strung out, and I was listening to all these stations coming in. What bothered me is that, you know, on those old radios, in Europe, people know this too, but also on the old days, they would have dots on the dial. Tokyo, London, Rome, Bern, you know. And you figured, you know, as a novice shortwave listener, you figured you could just turn the knob to any of those dots and they'd be there, you know, like your local radio station. And it took me a while to realize that, yes, they occasionally appeared or were registered on those frequencies, but you had to coordinate your listening time to receive them. That's what got me bitten, as Bob Tolman would say. That's the bug that got me, and I've been with it ever since. I started listening to radio hams and got a ham license in 1961. And I had broadcasting in my blood from the beginning. I always wanted to be into broadcasting. And that's what drove me to Europe and international broadcasting. It's shortwave radio that fascinated me as a kid. And to answer your question about CKGM, we came back, my fiancé at the time, and I wanted to come back. She was a little scared of the States because she'd never been there. Her English was a little bit ropey. And we said, look, why don't I try to get a job in Montreal? It's very European, it's a French, it's a continental culture up there. And I got the job. Jeff Sterling, a big name in Canadian broadcasting out in the Maritimes, he was the owner of CKGM at the time, which was, I believe, the major talk station. There was CJAD and CKGM, and they were fighting it out. And I landed the job, and I was in Montreal also as a student at Loyola College, which is now Concordia University, continuing my studies up there, and I was working at the same time. So you and I have something in common. We're both, as they say in local dialect, Montrealers.
Well, let me ask you, when you discovered international broadcasting and decided that you wanted to become a broadcaster, was it, I mean, if I give my own story behind it, when I used to listen to, for example, Joe Adamov doing Moscow Mailbag or the Tony Myatt Request Show, I always used to think, what was it like in the studio? What kind of equipment were they using? Oh, I wonder what, you know, that's the kind of thing that used to go through my mind all the time.
Well, as far as I'm informed, I've never seen the studios of Radio Moscow. I don't think they've changed much over the years, to tell you the truth. Not the official broadcasting, but he was always off mic, you know. This is Joe Adamov in the Soviet Union. Hello. You know, and it was charming. You could always tell Radio Moscow audio.
Well, you know, it's funny because when I worked at Radio Havana, Cuba for 3 years, the studios at Radio Havana, Cuba were designed by Soviet technicians that came from Radio Moscow. And, you know, I saw photographs of the Radio Moscow studios and I went, this is a carbon copy. And, you know, that effect where it sounds like Joe was on the other side of the room or Karo Igorov or one of the other announcers, that was understandable. For some reason, the microphones that these microphones that they had from the Soviet Union, which were not omnidirectional but directional microphones, were almost clear halfway across the room.
I once heard a technical explanation for this, and I don't know, I don't remember all the details. It had to do with standing waves. Now, not radio frequency standing waves, as we would know in radio transmission, but audio acoustic standing waves. Apparently, there was a belief among the Soviet audio technicians that this was a poor man's audio processor. They had nothing at the time. Technically, Radio Moscow was in the Stone Age. Their audio was terrible, and it was sort of like their version of a reverb unit, which they didn't get. you know? And so they just had this big echoey room. I think it came out of the 1930s and 40s. There was a belief in using theaters and big studios for radio, because it gave what they, for at the time, the big sound. You know, Bob Orban was a kid like I was in Butler, New Jersey, not too far from where I grew up, incidentally. Bob Orban is the acknowledged guru, grand swami, exalted mukti of audio processing equipment, which is probably used by the commercial stations in Moscow today. And he's what created the big sound for shortwave. That gave, you know, he took basically the old VOA audio clipper from the 1950s, the Cold War days, reworked it into high technology, and he's what has given shortwave that big, beautiful sound today. But the Russians either don't buy it, literally or figuratively, or it certainly in those days it just didn't exist. The only radio station that had that kind of audio processing at the time was The Voice of America, broadcasting in special English, you know, and they sounded like God. It was almost like psychological warfare. The VOA engineers developed this incredible audio clipper. And for anyone who doesn't know, a clipper, it's a form of audio processing called an RF clipper, which is extremely, it makes you sound exalt. It makes you sound like God himself. This is the voice of God. And I believe that this was part of, you know, Western psychological warfare, to sound literally bigger than your opponent. The Russians could never cut it in that field.
So, you know, you were in Montreal, international radio fascinated you, and then you ended up at SRI when you moved back to Switzerland with, how many years after you were in Montreal?
Well, I was in Montreal about 2 years, and to finish my studies. Excuse me. And I longed for Europe. My first taste of Europe in 1964 gave me a longing for it. I loved it. I loved the continental way of life. And don't forget, I was raised in the 50s. I was a 50s generation, born in 1945, and I went through that great golden age of the 1950s where European life was exalted. And it was just after the war. And I was a baby boomer, basically an early baby boomer, and we saw the movie theaters were full of, you know, Rome Holiday and all of these continental movies, and it just, I thought it was great. It was a great way of life, and I loved it. I traveled all over Europe for 8 weeks as you know, after high school, back in 1964, and I just fell in love with it, and I longed for it. Montreal is a beautiful city, and I consider it a second home. I love the city, I love the people, I love the culture of Montreal. If I lived in North America, I think, you know, I could recommend the city highly. But I had to get back to Bern. My wife was Bernese, and I just had a hankering for Switzerland. I loved it. And to make a long story short, I applied for a job at Swiss Radio International. I got a letter back from Joel Kirschow, who was one of the great directors of Swiss Radio International at the time. He said, "We are changing our format in spring 1970. We're going from recorded programs to live actuality radio and current affairs. The accent on current affairs features on the weekend. There is a new head of the English service taking over. His name is Mike McMahon, who just happens, parenthetically, or happened to come from London, Ontario. And they took my credentials. They took my application. I did a demo tape for them. I had the languages. I had the background. They were impressed by the fact that I had worked for Radio Sweden, because don't forget, at the time, I only had an American passport. Today, I also have a Swiss passport, which makes me kosher, so to speak. But in the days of the Cold War, they were suspicious of Americans. But people who had previous experience in a neutral country like Sweden and had Canadian experience, the Canadian aspect was, I think, important to my success in getting the job. I found out there were dozens of applicants for my job, and I simply filled the bill, and I got a letter back saying, Would you be willing to start work on the 1st of April, 1970? And in the meantime, a small anecdote. You might remember at that time that there was a major postal strike in Canada in 1970.
That's the year that I was born, Bob. I don't think I could remember that.
Well, let me tell you, son, my recollection goes back a little further.
I was on pins and needles. I was in my early 20s at the time. I was about 22 or 23. And, you know, I never got a letter back from Bern. And finally, I invested in a phone call, and I said, you know, I haven't heard anything from you. And they said, well, we haven't heard anything. You know, we sent you a proposal, you know, a contract offer. And I said, well, we got a postal strike here. So anyway, the postal strike ended. I got the contract, signed it, and I arrived. I'll never forget. I took the Swiss Air flight from Dorval to Bern. Actually, it was to Zurich. Arrived on the 27th of March, 1970, and started work on the 1st of April, just a couple of days later. And that's the story. That's the episode that brings me to Switzerland.
So when you started at SRI, what were you doing? Was it just working in the newsroom, or did they put you right away with Bob Thoman?
Well, neither nor, as a matter of fact. I was not. We had a separate newsroom. And I have to say, in all due respect for the old Swiss Radio International, not for the one in its last days, but in the heydays, I'm talking about the 70s, 80s, and early 90s, we had an exceptionally good newsroom, 24-hour newsroom, just like at RCI, Montreal. Swiss Radio International had its own newsroom. It worked from a number of news agencies, and we were highly respected for our news. I was not hired as a newsman. I was hired as a broadcaster, as a member of the English service. So I was a broadcast journalist, and I was responsible for presenting the daily actuality magazine called Dateline. Hello, this is Bob Zanotti, and welcome to Dateline Thursday. In today's edition, you know, we had 11, I think it was 11 live programs a day. Mm-hmm. And we only had a recording during the night when we went to bed around 8 o'clock in the afternoon. So I was very much in actuality, but I wore many hats. I interviewed politicians. I was in the federal parliament building very often. I interviewed scientists, actors, bankers. I mean, you name it. It was a pourpourri of all kinds of reporting, and I also did features. In my heyday, I was also seconded to international organizations in Geneva, for example, like the World Health Organization, the International Telecommunication Union, the International or the World Meteorological Organization, UNICEF. I did field reporting for them. I worked as an information delegate for the League of Red Cross Societies. So I had quite a colorful experience, quite a colorful career, and saw a great deal of the world, and I felt as though this was not working. This was a perpetual vacation. Now, as far as Bob Thoman is concerned, what happened when I arrived, there was the Swiss shortwave merry-go-round, as it was called, which had its origin in the 50s, was started by Bob Thoman, and he had an old format with a couple of women helping him out. And then they went into an intermediate phase in 69 where a guy by the name of David Simmons came in. Now, David is still around. He was basically a disc jockey at heart. Then David decided to go back to his native London. They were looking for somebody to fill in, you know. And they knew and they found out, of course, with my big mouth, it wasn't a secret, that I was a radio ham. And they said, oh, well, you know, they rubbed their hands together and said, well, it sounds like you belong together with Bob Thoman. We'd like you to do the merry-go-round with Bob Thoman. So that's the way it started. I think it was, was it the 1st of April or the 1st of May, somewhere around there in 1970. And we did the merry-go-round together, and we stayed together faithfully until the end when the hatchet came on the 4th of June, 1994. Bob was even in the hospital at one time, and we had a phone. We did it by phone when he had an appendectomy, and I had a back problem, a slipped disc that kept me out of work for a couple of weeks, and he came over to our house here in the Emmental, and we recorded upstairs. I was in great pain, but the merry-go-round always continued, and I think we can say we never missed one single edition in those 24 years.
You know, it's funny because at Switzerland, SwitzerlandSound.com, your website, you have some of the old shows that Bob did in the 1960s, and I was listening to them yesterday, and I have to say, they sound so stiff. They sound so stiff, and the two girls, they sound lovely. It's like they're trying to be hip and cool, but at the same time, they sound like so stiff.
Well, don't forget, we're looking back, we're turning the pages back in broadcasting history. The CD, which we did with Ian McFarlane, CD3, it's on www.dxer.ca. We talked about this, the style in shortwave broadcasting. And don't forget, that was a style of the 1940s and 1950s, and it may be. Well, there are a couple of things you have to realize. Bob Thoman was not a professional broadcaster. I think he did a very good job. He had a good personality that came through. But these two women were picked up, I don't know, because they know somebody, they spoke English. English is not a native language in Switzerland, and especially back in the 50s and 60s, English speakers were rare birds. No pun intended. And the fact is that they were, you know, the grapevine. Oh, do you know anybody who speaks English? We could use them for a, you know, it was a period of naivete in international broadcasting, especially in the Swiss context. And it was, I would use the word quaint. It was not highly polished, but this is not meant as criticism. I think this is one of the charms of the original Swiss shortwave merry-go-round. It was not highly polished. People who listened to it felt that they were listening to real people. So I think, though, that the two Bobs format really moved along, and we never pulled any punches. I think that's what made us very popular. We did our job. We gave people technical information. They would write to us with problems about radio. We got involved in politics, too. One of the biggest campaigns that we ran, we were under a little bit of pressure from the management too, I must say, who were saying, you know, can't you get the word to these DXers? And they would spit out the word DXer. DXers were persone non grate in SRI, and I think in other stations as well. When I say DXers, I mean the guys who just gave you a signal report and wanted a QSL card. Mm-hmm. And so Bob and I really turned up the heat on these people, and we made a few enemies, as a matter of fact. We went to European DX Council conferences, the first one I remember in Brussels back in 80-something or 79 or 80, I don't know, and we dropped this subnuclear weapon or tactical nuclear weapon, and it said, you've got to realize, guys, that we are not spending millions to issue you QSL cards. And the place went into a hush, and you know, people shook their heads and looked at us with wide eyes in amazement that we would dare say such a thing to DXers. But you know, it was true. We were spending millions, like the other broadcasters, to get listeners and not just reception reports. So that was one of the big campaigns. I think, if I may be a little bit immodest, I think we were responsible for coining the expression, which became established in the industry, program content. We were the first ones to talk about not just sending us a QSL card or asking for a QSL card with a signal report, but listen to the program. Listen to what we're telling you. You'll get your QSL card, but we want to hear about the programs too.
You know, just a moment ago, there was something, Bob, that you mentioned that brings me to this. You know, especially in the last maybe 15 or even 20 years, it seems that, well, from my ears, most international broadcasters pretty much sound the same. I can listen to Deutsche Welle or Radio Netherlands or others, and it's basically announcers that come in, do voice tracks, and then leave. And you hear a lot of this in commercial radio. You could be listening to a guy in the afternoon for maybe 6 hours. He's not even there. He goes in maybe once a week, records all these voice segments, and then leaves. And when I listen to the show, when you did Swiss Merry-Go-Round with Bob, or even Ian's show, or the Happy Station that Tom did, it was pretty much you guys were, and I don't mean to sound like you were, you know, the voice of Swiss Radio International, but you were just who you are. You were not on air trying to be somebody else. You were not trying to be there as just a cold voice. You were there as yourself.
Well, thank you very, very much for the point, and I'm terribly flattered and grateful that you make that point. It's very gratifying for me, and I'll tell you why. That was not a coincidence. I realized that very, very early on in my training as a broadcaster. I remember a great personality who probably very few people will ever remember. You might look him up on Google. Arthur Godfrey.
I know that name, yes. I know the name, and I've heard some of the old shows.
Well, Arthur Godfrey was a radio ham, as a matter of fact, and he also was a pilot, and he was one of the great, he was the little guy, he was a guy who used to be very laid back and strum a ukulele, and he had a talk show, a sort of a forerunner of Johnny Carson. Daytime on CBS, and it also went to television, the Arthur Godfrey Show. And I remember once in college talking about Arthur Godfrey, and we had a discussion about it, and Arthur Godfrey was once asked, to what do you attribute your success? You have a personality. People follow you. You have a tremendous popularity. To what do you attribute your success? And his answer, I'll never forget it, and it stuck with me the rest of my professional life, I'm myself. And I developed on that philosophy, tried it myself, and found out that it worked. You can never, ever, Keith, be anyone but yourself. And this is not only true of broadcasting, it's true for anything else in life. People, we underestimate the power of perception of the audience. One of the other things which I also came to realize is how intimate radio is. And this is another thing the old timers taught me, and I never forgot it. When you are on the air as a broadcaster, there are only two people listening to you. The microphone and the technician. And I hear things that to me, it's intimate. When you're talking, you talk to one person. And one of the things that boils my blood today is this egocentric rubbish that I hear constantly. Well, good evening, all of you out there in Radio Land. You know, you don't talk to all of you out there. You talk to you. Good evening, and thank you for listening. You. It's a great thing in the English language because there's no differentiation between singular and plural. It's more difficult in other languages. But thank you for listening. And there is someone at a radio on the other side of the loudspeaker who trusts you, and they can feel the vibrations of sincerity. You know, you can never, I'll say it again, you can never be anyone in this life but yourself. And people feel that. If you're conning them, if you're putting them on, they're going to feel it. And this is what is so unconvincing about so much cheap commercial radio.
Well, you know, something that I've never talked about on Happy Station before, but people have asked me the question, why did I leave China Radio International? And the reason actually was management. After working there for, I was probably coming up to 5.5 years. And the last 6 months before I left, I was extremely unhappy because a new management team came in. And, you know, I mean, for example, like if you or Ian or Tom Meyer called me up or Bob Thorman and said, Keith, you're an idiot. What the hell are you doing? I mean, I pay attention. But when it's people who didn't come from broadcasting backgrounds, I always found it extremely difficult. And when I quit, it was really funny. And this is the first time I'm telling this. What had happened, it was a Friday afternoon. I was coming into the last hour of my show and I was saying to myself, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. I just don't want to do this anymore. And I don't know what happened, but in the last 3 minutes of my show, coming up to like 5 o'clock, I announced my resignation on air.
Oh boy.
Before telling management. Now, normally I would have told management before, but the problem is I didn't respect them because they didn't respect me. So I announced my resignation on the air. The funny thing is they were not listening. Monday came around, they heard the air check, and they said, oh, well, you didn't quit, you were just saying that because my contract was also coming to the end, and they thought it was just a negotiating ploy, and I said, no, I've had it, I said. This new management team that you have know nothing about radio. They're nothing but bean counters and lawyers, and they're telling us, the on-air personalities, how to do our jobs. I said, if you bring somebody in who knows about radio, then maybe I would listen.
No, I can appreciate that story. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you right now, my final years at SRI, when SRI became Swiss Info, were very unpleasant. I was harassed. I had physical illness as a result, physical and psychological illness as a result. To use a local term, I was mobbed. This is officially documented by medical authority. They were doing everything to punish the old-timers and to try to demoralize them, to push them to resign. Mm-hmm. And I hung on, even though it was detrimental to my health. And for the last several years of SRI, we had a guy who was in charge of the English service and the newsroom combined. He was a newsman, had no business talking to creative people. In fact, as a newsman, he was quoted by people a number of times as having said, I hate these creative people. In fact, there's a term I will not use on the air, so-called arty you-know-whats.
Yeah.
And he got his revenge when he was erroneously given the job of running the English service. And he and I, we had good relations up to that point, but then that was the end of it. And I was basically deprived of any reporting work, which he knew very well. I was my whole life's blood. Being on the air, being a microphone guy, going out in the field. But I was given menial jobs, I was given clerical jobs to do, editing other people's work for the SRI transcription service, instead of being out there and doing a better job myself. Those are periods which, frankly, even today I suffer as a result. I'm saying this for the first time on your show. I have never become so personal and open about this. And let them sue me if they want. I don't think they will because I can prove it. My leaving SRI was not happy. I always dreamed eventually, you know, when you retire, you're going to be, you'll have a little party like everybody did and have a goodbye drink and you'd get a present from everybody and you'd shake hands with everybody and walk out the door and feel as though your efforts over the years had been appreciated. Well, that didn't happen to me, you know. We were simply told we were being given early retirement. I wasn't the only one. There were a couple of others as well, the senior people, when they were moving towards internet text-based only radio. I say radio. It's my instinct coming back. It has nothing to do with radio. In fact, Swiss Radio International legally does not exist anymore. So my leaving there was a blessing. On the one hand, I first year or two after that, I loved it. You know, as the Italians say, "Io fatto il dolce fa niente." You know, the beautiful doing nothing. And I started my website as a result. I felt creative need to do something. So on the 1st of August 2004, I launched the website. I got tremendous energy. Nobody believed that website went up in the space of 3 months. It was incredible. And it still is heavily visited, which is great. In the meantime, I must confess I have neglected it a bit. We still have actuality updates, but I'd like to get out again. I'm getting itchy to get a microphone in my hand and do some more creative and colorful reporting for the website. But that was my compensation for not being on microphone anymore. So in that sense, SwitzerlandInSound.com is my continuing effort to be creative in the same style, in the same vein and manner that when I was working in the heyday. And as a matter of fact, and I say modestly and factually, Switzerland in Sound is the only source of any serious radio reporting about Switzerland available today. There's nothing on shortwave, and it's the only way to go for anyone who remembers the old Swiss Radio International. Switzerland in Sound is it. That's all that's left.
You know, what's interesting is recently I was asked, you know, after I left CRI, did I ever think about working in another station again? And I have to tell you, you know what? At this point in my life, I prefer what I'm doing now, working as an independent producer, doing my own distribution, and not having to worry about management or anything like that. Now, I do work at a local station here in Taiwan, but their attitude is, well, he's the foreigner, so we just leave him do what he wants, which suits me fine. Let's change to something a little bit more offbeat for a moment, Bob. I don't know if you're like this, but I'm the kind of person, I could be sitting somewhere having a coffee or reading a newspaper, and all of a sudden I will get the weirdest idea in my head.
That's the way creativity works.
Here's one for you. This is a trivia question, and let's see. I wanted to figure out also if many of our listeners out there would even probably figure this out. But there was a TV show which has become part of pop culture, where shortwave radio was mentioned. Well, not just shortwave, but medium wave or shortwave or even ham radio was mentioned in every few episode of this TV series that lasted 3 years. Do you have any idea what it could be?
I'm sorry, I don't. I'm not a great TV guy. I've got a lot of general knowledge, but you got me on that one, Keith.
Well, let me give you another clue, which is probably giving it away. The radio they had was a white radio, and they would recharge the batteries using coconuts.
Gee, I'm sorry, you got me. You got me.
Do you remember Gilligan's Island?
Well, I do remember Gilligan's Island, but I was not a viewer of it.
I picked up the series when I was in Japan, and I was watching it, and I'm going, wait a second. The professor is charging this radio using coconuts. He uses shortwave to demagnetize something. He's using dipoles and something else to contact a spaceship. Somebody lands on the island who is for some contest, and he has a ham radio with him. And I realized after I finished watching the DVDs that almost every second or third episode, AM or ham radio, had to do in some way around the plot.
Well, I tell you something. I hear this for the first time because I used to catch some of the old shows, you know, in the 60s and 70s. Well, not the 70s anymore, the 60s especially. And I knew about Gilligan's Island. I can still see the guy. I forget his name, but it was Bob somebody, I think. Was
Bob Denver.
Bob Denver, yeah, exactly. But I wouldn't draw a connection between Gilligan's Island and shortwave. Well, thank you for making the point.
You know, a while ago on the show when I did my first tribute to DXers, you sent in a funny anecdote about Sinpo, where you said that you had egg on your face.
Well, I think I was still right. I still think the Sinpo code is too complicated, but the egg on my face was when I told it to this audience in Sweden, not knowing that the inventor of the code was in the audience.
Well, you know, after you mentioned that, there's something that came to mind that happened in 19... Oh, it was the early 90s, and it was when I was freelancing at Radio Canada International. In Quebec history, there was something known as the Oka Crisis. I don't know if you remember that.
What year was that?
I think it was 1990 or 1991. I don't remember the exact year. Yeah, but it was two native reserves that had blocked. One had blocked off a bridge. One had closed off a community.
Oh, yeah. I heard about that. Yeah.
Well, there's a funny story involving Ian McFarland with this, and it was all my fault. I was up in Oka, Quebec, to cover the siege because it was like 2 months, and they wanted me to do a live Q&A. Now, back in those days, mobile phones are not what they are now. So they had difficulty reaching me on a mobile phone. So I said, well, here's a phone number. If you call me, you have to call me at this time, and I will be there, and we can do the Q&A. They tried before. There was a problem with the line. I said, well, give me the studio number, and I will call you. And they said, okay, call at like 10 minutes after 9, or try to call before so we can put you on first. And I went, okay. So there I was. I dialed the phone. I heard the phone pick up and then hang up. I called again. I heard it pick up and hang up. I called again. Somebody picked it up and hung it up. And then I called a fourth time. The line was busy. Then I called again. And then the production assistant picked it up. Well, the next day, when I went to RCI, I saw Ian. And Ian said to me, "You ruined my newscast." And I went, "What happened?" He said, "Go listen to the air check." So I listened to the air check. Basically, what had happened is the technicians had left the phone in the studio with Ian as Ian was reading news. So you can hear Ian saying, "This is Radio Canada International. Here's the news to Southeast Asia." Ring, ring, ring. He picks it up, hangs it up. It happened again. The third time, he picks it up, and I'm going, "Hello? Hello?" The microphone is picking this up. Dead silence for about 15 seconds. And then it was what Ian said at the end. Ian said, "I apologize for that. There won't be any further interruptions."
This jogs my memory. I got to tell you this. When I was negotiating for a job in Montreal back in 1968, I got a job offer from a radio station in Sherbrooke, Quebec. And that was a talk station as well. And I don't remember the call letters. And the guy gave me a phone call or phone number to call when I was in town or what to contact him. He was the manager of the station. And so I called this guy. I was in New Jersey back at my parents' house. And I called this guy. I called the number that he gave me. "Call me when you're in town." And I called him. I said, "Mr. Jones, this is Bob Zanotti. I'm calling about the job offer that you, know." And we're going, I said, I'm very pleased that you're interested in considering me. I mean, tell me about your station." He said, "Well, Bob, I appreciate it if you'd call me back another time. We're right in the middle of something." It turned out I called a guy back. He had given me the on-air phone number. And he was doing a telephone talk show at the time. I haven't thought of that one for a long time. That was a fun bit.
You know, there's things that happen in radio which, when I think now, they are rather funny. When I was at Radio Havana, Cuba, I was doing an interview with somebody from the State Department in Washington, and he'd been told that this is a radio interview. Anyway, 6 minutes through the interview, he said, "Oh, by the way, what station is this for?" And I said, "Radio Havana, Cuba." He paused, and he says, "Are you recording this?" I said, "Yes, we're recording this. This is an interview." And he said, "Oh, you know, in our country, it's illegal to record conversations without telling the other party." And I said, "Yeah, but not in this country."
I think broadcasters, every broadcaster has got a load of anecdotes. Actually, there's one. You talk about embarrassing moments. When you asked me to contribute an embarrassing moment, it was about SWLs, but I had a very embarrassing moment on the air one time. We sometimes were asked to read the news. We were not news people, but occasionally they were short of a news reader. So we were asked to read the news. And I don't know what happened. Maybe, I don't know, a couple of the guys, we used to do that at SRI. You know, we'd break for a drink in mid-afternoon. This was part of the culture at SRI. And I came back, and there was a terrible air crash on the American-Mexican border. This is, I guess, sometime in the 70s or early 80s. And one of your compatriots, Paul Suffren, the late Paul Suffren, for those who didn't know, Paul passed away about a year ago, 2008, after a long illness. He was a very, very dear and close friend of mine. We had many, many times together. And I'll tell you another anecdote involving him. But I was reading the news, and the top news story was the plane crash on the American-Mexican border. And I was not drunk. I don't want to give that impression. We happened to have been out, and I think we had lunch or something together, and we, as usual in this part of the world, we had some wine with the lunch. But I'm not blaming it on the wine. I just had a cranial short circuit. Paul Suffren introduces the program. Hello, welcome to Dateline. This is Paul Suffren. In today's edition, we have a comment on the situation in the Middle East. We have, you know, he's going down the list. But first, here's Bob Zanotti with the news. And I said, and here are the headlines. There's been a major plane crash on the Mexican-American border, and, you know, down, blah, 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 blah. The first tasters, 3-4 items. And then I get into the main story. And this is not really funny, but, you know, after so many years of, you know, time gone by and water under the bridge, I have to tell it. It happened. It's the truth. The one thing I'm devoted to passionately is the truth, even if I'm the object of it. And I just started to read the story, and something happened. I said, there has been a major plane crash on the Mexican-American border. Reportedly, 128 people have died, some of them seriously. And there was another time when Paul Suffren was signing. He was in a good mood. This was, I guess, the waning years of SRI. And I heard it upstairs. Everybody heard it on the internal intercom. Nobody believed their ears. And nothing happened. He said, well, that's the end of Dateline today. This is Paul Suffren, thanking you both for listening. Nothing happened. Management said nothing. As a matter of fact, I wonder in some of those later years how many people were really listening. I don't know.
You know, that reminds me of one of my Chinese colleagues at China Radio International. A wonderful guy, and I've remained friends with him years after I left. His name is Xin Ting, and he studied English in the UK, but he was very colloquial with his English. And he was doing this story on a traditional wedding ceremony that takes place in one area of China. So you could just picture him with his mixture English-Chinese accent. He goes, during the traditional wedding ceremony, the bride hands a chicken to the groom, and the groom clutches the chicken for the entire ceremony. In return, the groom hands the bride his cock.
Can you get away with it? I guess so, yeah.
And this went on the air, and it was one of those moments that everybody just started, and he had no idea. He was in the studio reading it. It went on the air, and it was just like our sports commentator went to South Korea to cover the Asian Games, and it was the day that China lost the ping pong match but won the volleyball match. And I was hosting CRI's morning show that week when the host was away, and I said, now we're going to cut to Liu Xin in South Korea. Leo, what are the headlines for last night's games? And she said, well, Keith, big balls win, small balls lose.
Well, since we're in this vein of discussion, I can remember one of my first jobs at SRI back in the early 70s was to review some archive tapes. We used to go back to the archives sometimes and rebroadcast material. And we had an interview with Conan Doyle, you know, the Sherlock Holmes Conan Doyle. It was Adrian Conan Doyle, an interview with him done in the, the late 50s or early 60s or something. And I think he actually died. That's why I was asked to pick out a clip that we could play on the air. He had a house in the Bernese Oberland, like so many of the English gentry did. And he had a lisp. Don't worry, I'm not going to be too graphic here. We could do it in Europe, but I think for a worldwide audience, especially being broadcast over an American station, I wouldn't do it. Anyway, he had the lisp. And he talked like this all the time. And he was talking about his father and what his father would do and his memories of his father in Switzerland. And he said the phrase, let me put it this way, the phrase he meant to say is he would come into the room, sit on the floor, and gaze into the fire. And I listened to the tape, and it came out as my father would come into the room, he would, on the floor, and gaze into the fire. I called Mike McMahon, the head of the service. I said, Mike, you can't put this on the air. He said, what's the matter? He said, listen to this. He said, holy. I said, yeah, that's what I thought. And you broadcast this already? He says, yeah, nobody noticed.
That, of course, is the perfect way to end the interview with somebody doing something on a floor. And I was speaking there with Bob Zanotti, former announcer at Swiss Radio International and host of the Swiss Shortwave Merry-Go-Round for 24 years with Bob Thoman. And with that, we've come to the end of one of our special programs, Happy Station's Tribute to the Xers. I hope that you enjoyed the show as much as I have, listening to that over and over again. If you have any comments or questions, please send them along. And of course, suggestions and story ideas for our next Happy Station Tribute to the Xers program. Our email address is pcj.happystation@gmail.com. That's pcj.happystation@gmail.com. And if you want to find out more about what Bob Zanotti is up to today and to find out more information about Switzerland, you can check out the website for Switzerland in Sound, which is just that, switzerlandinsound.com. That's www.switzerlandinsound.com. I should also mention at this point that this edition of the Happy Station Show is being broadcast to all regions. That's right, to all regions. So on behalf of my guest, Bob Zanotti, all the way in Switzerland, this is Keith Perron in Taipei, Taiwan, hoping that you join me again very soon for another edition of the show. So until next time, friends, so long. Au revoir. Auf Wiedersehen. Adios, amigos. And sayonara.
This is the Happy Station.
That's what happiness is. Happiness is, happiness is, happiness is, happiness is, happiness is, happiness is. Different things to different people. That's what happiness is.
Happiness is the Happy Station, bringing you some weekly peace, cheer, and joy. Remember that? Hello, I'm Keith Perron, and I hope that you will join me Thursdays at 1 and 15 hours UTC
for the Happy Station and La Estación de la Alegría, right here via Radio Miami International.